This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
An Bord erwarten Sie Bars, Spa-Duschen sowie preisgekrönte Bordunterhaltung. Es ist also kein Wunder, dass Emirates als beste Fluggesellschaft der Welt ausgezeichnet wurde. Wir fliegen Sie zu über 140 Reisezielen. Und mit unseren Interline-Partnern weltweit bieten wir Ihnen Anschlussflüge zu weiteren 1700 Städten auf 6 Kontinenten. Wenn wir behaupten, dass wir eine der größten internationalen Fluggesellschaften sind, meinen wir, wir bringen Sie an Ihr Wunschziel. Jetzt buchen auf emirates.de. Fly Emirates. Fly better.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm David Harper, and on this edition, we are talking about the effects or otherwise of fresh EU sanction on Moscow, but we're also talking about the Russian Shadow Fleet, a ghostly group of ships that transport goods around the world with questionable ownership. Also, how could the cost of living in Germany affect the results of Sunday's election?
There are a lot of people who are living on the edge, and I don't know how they're managing now. So I can well imagine that they are dissatisfied and maybe won't vote the way the mainstream would like them to.
We've been hearing from voters there, and we were hoping to talk to you about South Africa's budget today, but we can't because it hasn't happened. So we'll be finding out why. First, though, in the last few days, we've seen the conversation around Russia and Ukraine raised back up the diplomatic agenda. Here is the European Commission President, Ursula von der Leyen, speaking at the Munich Security Conference on Friday.
The authoritarians of this world are carefully watching whether there's any impunity if you invade your neighbour and violate international borders, or whether there are real deterrents. They are watching us very carefully, what actions we choose to take. And this is why it is so important that we get this right. Ukraine needs peace through strength.
Well, as the US and Russia hold talks without the involvement of other countries, the EU has announced further sanctions against Moscow. The measures include targets on the aluminium sector, disconnecting more banking institutions from the SWIFT payment system, and banning more Russian media outlets from Europe. But we've heard all this before. Sanctions have been used as a tool against Vladimir Putin since the Ukraine invasion started, and Russian trade has always found ways to continue. So will this latest announcement make a difference at all? Alexander Kolyanda is senior researcher at CEPA, a Centre for European Political Analysis, and joins us live now. Alexander, thank you for being with us. Well, let me put that question to you. How will this be received in Moscow? Will it make a difference at all?
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me. I don't believe that Moscow would lose its sleep over the 19th package of the European sanctions. The official line of the Kremlin is that the sanctions do not affect Russian economy. I wouldn't subscribe to that. Sanctions do affect Russian economy, but they do not make the Russian economy collapsing anytime soon, or at least this year. So if 3 years ago, when the war started, the initial idea was that with sanctions strong enough, it would be possible to force Vladimir Putin to stop his war of aggression against Ukraine, withdraw his troops, and just behave in the future. So that obviously didn't happen. However, the sanctions imposed by the European Union, by the United Kingdom, and by the United States are pretty strong, and they do slow down Russian economy. They do affect Russian economy.
Well, can we look at some of these individually just for a moment? Because to start with SWIFT, we've already discussed in the past the disconnection of some Russian banking institutions from the SWIFT payment system, which for the benefit of those who may not be aware, is the system by which banks communicate for international transfers. How much of a problem would isolating banks from SWIFT be?
Well, now it wouldn't be a problem. I mean, I haven't seen the list of the European sanctions. It will be published on Monday, as far as I know. But all the major Russian banks have been already cut off. So it wouldn't affect the banking system.
And they found ways to continue despite that?
Yes. And the main idea behind the majority of the European sanctions is to prevent European crucial export to reach Russia through the intermediary countries, be it former Soviet states of the Central Asia, United Arab Emirates, Turkey, China, of course, and the rest. So they sanctioned the banks to make it more difficult and more expensive.
If we look at the line about the media and banning certain media outlets from operating in Europe, is that potentially more about censorship than it is about an economic issue?
I don't think that there is an economic angle there, but I understand that from the point of view of the European politicians, Russian state media is more, I would say, more propaganda than media. And they do not regard it as an onslaught on the freedom of speech.
And
however, Moscow does call it this way.
And just quickly, we've seen these very high-profile talks between the United States and Russia. If there is the potential for a reduction of sanctions from the US, does that make these new European announcements a little bit irrelevant?
No, it doesn't. Because I don't expect American sanctions to be lifted by Tuesday. And the more sanctions we have now, the more difficult it will be to lift them. And the Americans have already said that there would be no lifting of the sanctions until after the peace deal, whatever the peace deal that might be. And every little helps. Every clog in the Russian economic system makes it less effective and makes it a little bit difficult to sustain the current level of economic growth.
Alexander, do stay with us because we're going to stay with this broader topic for a moment. We're going to talk about the Russian shadow fleet, as it's become known, which is a key part of the discussion about Russian trade outside of sanctions. It's a contentious issue, not just about trading, but also about marine safety. Elizabeth Brough is a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and has written extensively on the subject and joins us live now. I've got to ask you, first of all, Elizabeth, what exactly is the shadow fleet and how does it work?
It is essentially what it says on the tin, a collection of ships that sail outside the official shipping system. So they frequently change flags and they flag with countries that are not established maritime nations, countries like Gabon, Eswatini, the Cook Islands, and so forth. And they also have obscure owners, in fact, owners so obscure that they deliberately hide their identity between behind brass plate addresses in places like the UAE and India. And they also frequently, these ships frequently disguise their whereabouts so that it's harder to know where they are and where they might be heading. And they also don't have, for all intents and purposes, they don't have functional accident insurance. And that is a very major issue because they are likely to cause and to have accidents because, and that's the last part of why they are so concerning. They are very old. They are usually if vessels that have reached retirement age and been sold by their previous owners into this shadow fleet. And one thing that is worth remembering is it's not an established fleet. It's just a collection of vessels. Nobody looks after these vessels. They just sail in the shadows, as it were.
And the suggestion being that they are transporting goods for Russia sort of under the radar, potentially. You mentioned a little bit about the dangers of these ships, which potentially may not be in the best of condition. This has caused a lot of concern, particularly in the states around the Baltic Sea.
It has, because a lot of Russia's oil is transported out of Russia's Baltic seaports. And I think the key thing to remember in this context is that shadow vessels transport Russian oil above the price caps. That's a price cap. That is why Russia has turned to the shadow fleet. They transport other things for other countries that are under sanctions. But in the case of Russia, that's what they primarily transport. And so you have enormous amounts of Russian oil being transported through the Baltic Sea on these vessels that are in many cases not seaworthy and because they hide their whereabouts are more likely to cause accidents. So it's an environmental disaster waiting to happen in the Baltic Sea every single day.
And given you what you've said about their obscure ownership and registration, what exactly can be done about it?
It is extremely hard to figure out what can be done about it. And that's why we haven't really seen any effective measures so far. Western governments try to sanction charter vessels, but it's very time consuming, precisely because their owners do their best to hide details and indeed their own identity. And then the other thing is that the moment you sanction one charter vessel, another one will be sold into the charter fleet. So nothing much improves. I think what can be done at this point is to create within Europe or within the wider Western world a public list of the owners of these vessels. They thrive in the shadows, and we don't have a public list that everybody can access.
But presumably the real operators of these ships won't be jumping to be part of a public list if they can avoid it.
No, that's why they are so energetically hiding behind brass plate names, but brass plate company names. But we have very good investigators in our Western countries. We have people in the FBI who are used to finding those who don't want to be found. We have the investigators in Italy's Carabinieri and Guardia di Finanza. They are experts at finding people who don't want to be found. If we pool our resources, our investigative resources, I'm sure we could find at least a partial list of the people who make this shadow fleet happen simply by buying the vessels and allowing them to sail. And they would not like to be found. And the moment they're found and identified and their names are out there in the public, I think they would think twice about operating these vessels.
Elizabeth, thank you very much for explaining it to us. Elizabeth Brough from the Atlantic Council, who's written extensively on the subject of the Russian shadow fleet. Let's move on and bring in Danny Hewson, head of financial analysis at AJ Bell, who is going to talk a little bit about some of the market reaction. And we mentioned some of the Russian potential sanctions around aluminium exports. That presumably has had a reaction in the markets.
It has had a reaction in the markets. Yeah, the aluminium price hit a one-month high today. There's been an awful lot of volatility in that sector, of course, because of the sanctions which have been imposed by Donald Trump of 10%, which will come in shortly. We've also seen a number of Indian metal companies on the rise as well. Hindalco shares up 4% today, although that also has something to do with an outperform rating by JP Morgan, which has been added to that today. So yeah, a lot of focus on this, particularly at a time when the EU is feeling sidelined by what is going on with talks between Russia and the United States about the future in Ukraine. So this is one way that the EU is really sort of demonstrating its continued relevance in this area.
Alexander is still with us. I mean, if we're seeing a high price for aluminium at the moment, given that Russia is still selling to some countries, that's not necessarily a bad thing for them.
No, it's not. And I don't think that the sanctions against Russian aluminium would hurt Russia that much. As far as I understand, Russia accounts only to about 6% of the European aluminium imports, and Russian major aluminium exporter Rusal has been preparing for that for a while. So Russia would be able to move its export to the east, to China. So I think that if there is anything that threatens Russian aluminium production, it is not the European sanctions, but a possible slowdown in China.
And just very quickly, Danny, also on the markets, we've seen reaction to a UK inflation jump to 3% today.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a surprise jump in inflation. Most economists had expected around 2.8%. So at 3.3%, it is way above the Bank of England's 2% target. And of course, all that has then started the discussion about when the Bank of England might be able to cut interest rates again. Markets still expecting 2 rate cuts this year, but they've pushed back the expectation when they think that will happen into May, maybe even later in the summer.
Danny, thank you very much. And Elizabeth and Alexander, thank you for joining us just to talk through the details of some of what we've seen and the wide-ranging effects of that EU announcement. You are with World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Now, Germans head to the ballot box on Sunday to cast their votes in a snap federal election. One of the main issues in this vote is the economy, which is struggling. Germany's economy is Europe's largest, but it contracted by 0.2% last year and is forecast to grow only 0.3% in 2025. Kevin Kainers is a reporter in Berlin, and he's been talking to people in the city's Treptower Park about how the economy is shaping their vote in this election.
I regularly watch the daily news, so I know that the economic situation is bad.
Margaret Rader is a retired doctor. She watches the news every day, which here is full of stories about the struggling economy. I spoke to her on a brisk, cloudy day here in Treptower Park, a large grassy area lined with trees in the south of Berlin, which is a popular place for locals to take a walk and chat with friends on a winter's day. Many of the conversations I heard were about politics, with the election and the cost of living on people's minds.
Das weiß ich schon. Also, es sieht nicht gut aus und es scheint.
So it doesn't look good, and it seems that people are trying to explain it by saying that energy has become too expensive, and that this has made the economy too expensive compared to other countries.
In Deutschland der Wirtschaftsstand zu teuer ist im Vergleich zum Ausland.
A few meters away, I met a retired teacher. He was relaxing on a bench as he waited for his wife.
The economic situation is difficult.
He also pinned some of the blame for the poor economic situation on high energy prices. But all sorts of expenses have gone up for him. He notices it every time he goes to shop for groceries.
Just as an example, I like to bake cakes. And if you buy yeast before Corona, it cost 9 cents a pack, then went up to 15 cents, and now it's 19 cents. That's more than 100% increase. And that's just one example. There are other examples too. Broadly speaking, the food sector, including fruit and everything else.
According to one recent poll by the public service TV station ZDF, 44% of German voters said the economy was the most important factor influencing their choice. That certainly seemed to be the case back in the park.
Mm-hmm. My name is Tanya, and I'm a teacher here in Berlin.
Tanya says she feels safe in her job, but says many other people are dealing with growing uncertainty.
For individuals, I think it's harder because there are a lot of mini jobs that are temporary jobs or that you ask to come in to work for a couple of hours and then you're released again. So it's very unstable, the situation for non-academics, so to say.
Ricardo is 30.
I'm a veterinarian.
He moved to Germany as a teen and got his citizenship 5 years ago. He says because so many people bought pets during the pandemic, his job is going well. But he says that people around him are having a much harder time.
Many people are struggling to find jobs after being cut from their companies.
Do you have friends like that?
Yeah, some friends, yeah. In the artistic field, more of like visual arts. I also have a very close friend, which is a photographer. He's fine, but sometimes there's also periods where he doesn't get any work at all. So it's very, for some people, it's very unpredictable, I guess.
All of this economic uncertainty is having a knock-on effect on politics. People are finding costs going up across the board, including on rent. And as our retired teacher says, that's affecting how people might vote.
Fortunately, we're not so tight that we can't pay for it. But there are a lot of people who are living on the edge, and I don't know how they're managing now. So I can well imagine that they are dissatisfied and maybe won't vote the way the mainstream would like them to.
And that way, well, the far-right Alternative für Deutschland, or AfD, is expected to do well in this election, which is even more of a concern for most people I spoke to than the economy. The party has been consistently polling second in Germany for more than a year and a half.
The economy, I'm more influenced by the danger from the right.
Die Gefahr von rechts. Die Wirtschaft, ich weiß
the economy, I don't really know how to improve it either.
Kevin Kainer's reporting from Berlin, speaking to some of the voters about some of their economic concerns ahead of the election this weekend. Now, this slot in today's World Business Report was set aside to bring you the details of the South African budget announcement. We can't do that, though, because it hasn't happened. It's been delayed by Parliament at very short notice in an unprecedented move. The Democratic Alliance, the second party in the coalition, says it wants to discuss its resolute position on the budget process after reports that the government is considering increasing taxes. Well, David Omojolomo is an economist from Capital Economics who focuses on Africa and joins us live on the programme now. David, this was really a last-minute decision. It took us somewhat by surprise. Did it take you by surprise as well?
Hi, David. It definitely took us by surprise. We were waiting at, 12 p.m. our time, as in to see the kind of budget be presented. And minutes passed. There was a lot of kind of wandering around by representatives to then find out that it wasn't happening, due to a kind of disagreement between the ANC and DA, the parties in the government for national unity.
How much do we know about the sticking points here between the two parties?
That's the interesting thing. We seem to know quite a bit. It was briefed before, which makes us wonder why the kind of budget speech wasn't delayed earlier or postponed earlier. It seems to be around a VAT proposed rise, as the ANC, or the GNU in total, is trying to carry on with its fiscal consolidation plans, so plans to kind of raise taxes, reduce spending to put their public finances on a better footing. The DA wasn't particularly happy with this proposed tax rises, seeing it as anti-growth, and withdrew their support for this budget, and that's why the budget speech didn't go ahead.
And we're expecting to see an announcement next month. The markets, though, won't like this. We've seen a drop in the rand and in investors unhappy just with the uncertainty of it. How on earth do people plan if they don't know what the outcome's going to be?
It's extremely hard to plan. As you said at the beginning, this is really unprecedented. The rand has lost about 1% of its value at its peak against the dollar just after this announcement. And investors have... There's always been a bit of investor certainty about the fragility of this government of national unity. The ANC and DA come from very different policy kind of ideologies. And there's a question as to whether there could be more kind of disagreements as we go further down the track. They've got a lot that they don't share in terms of policy kind of ideology. So we worry how easy it is going to be for the government to push through its growth ambitions, carry on putting the public finances on a more stable footing, if this is the type of thing that could happen again.
I was going to ask about that fragility, because there's a question in how this will sit with the wider process there. But in a more short-term thing, we're expecting to see an announcement next month. But if they can't agree now, how do we know that they will be able to agree in March?
It's a really interesting one. It's easy to say after the fact, but it clearly shows there isn't a kind of facility within the government and national unity to kind of bridge these policy differences. I think a new date for the budget has been announced, March 12th, which isn't very far away. And so there's just a big question as to whether they're going to be able to come round for the kind of good of the country to put forward a budget, which needs to be put through before the new fiscal year starts. So we think they will come to an agreement. We think they will come to a fudge, because the stakes are just too high if they don't. But it's clearly a worry.
David, stay with us. But I want to bring in Alan Beazley, who is a South African MP with Action SA, who are one of the opposition parties. Alan, your reaction to the delay that we've seen today?
Yeah, so it was extremely disappointing, and the key thing is that they would have gone through a process before today. So it's not like the DA and the other parties in the GNU hadn't actually seen the budget. I mean, they're part of the cabinet, so it would have been discussed. There's a whole process that happens before it gets presented to Parliament. So it's just, for me, I just find it quite bizarre that they fell out an hour before it was meant to be presented. It's a process that goes on for a couple of months. So I actually think what's happened is that they realised that there's going to be a groundswell against these tax increases, and then the DA changed their tune at the last moment and withdrew their support. But they had ample time before today to do it, and it just makes, you know, South Africa, and just it just the spotlight's being shone in South Africa at the moment for just some crazy foreign policy decisions that we're actually making. And as South Africans, we don't need this. We need confidence in the market, confidence by people, confidence in investors. And this is not going to generate the confidence. So extremely disappointing from Action SA's perspective.
And actually, when it comes to trade and industry in South Africa, at a time when the ability to trade with the US is not guaranteed, presumably that stability is very important.
No, it's critically important, and everything comes down to confidence. You want to give people confidence that you know South Africa is a good place to invest in. But if we can't pass a budget, if we can have such chaos, it's the first time in 30 years that a budget hasn't been passed. It just doesn't instill confidence. And that for me is just such the disappointing thing. We're desperate for foreign investment. We're desperate for confidence in our country. And the GNU is failing to deliver that. And they must all take blame for it, because they would have had ample opportunity to discuss it before it came to Parliament today.
And in terms of the points that they are discussing, and we believe it's over tax rises. I've been reading things you've written about the desire to invest in industry in South Africa. A tax rise is going to be a necessary thing to do to stabilise the economy and to be able to invest in industry.
No, well, not really, because the way we argue it, I've only been in Parliament for 6 months. I come from a business background, and I got into Parliament to try and make a difference. But the amount of wastage and corruption and incompetence that's happening in the state entities, it is absolutely frightening. And our viewpoint is it's actually wrong to penalise the people. The poorest of the poor get hurt with VAT increases because of the incompetence, corruption and wastage that's actually happening in South Africa at the moment.
Sorry to interrupt, but we're short on time. David, very quickly, is corruption a big factor in this?
I think that's probably outside of my kind of remit in terms of how big an issue corruption is in the country. But there is a challenge that the GNU faces in how it kind of fixes its public finances, whether it's cutting down on spending.
We will have to leave it there. Thank you very much, both of you.
An Bord erwarten Sie Bars, Spa-Duschen sowie preisgekrönte Bordunterhaltung. Es ist also kein Wunder, dass Emirates als beste Fluggesellschaft der Welt ausgezeichnet wurde. Wir fliegen Sie zu über 140 Reisezielen. Und mit unseren Interline-Partnern weltweit bieten wir Ihnen Anschlussflüge zu weiteren 1700 Städten auf 6 Kontinenten. Wenn wir behaupten, dass wir eine der größten internationalen Fluggesellschaften sind, meinen wir bringen Sie an Ihr Wunschziel. Jetzt buchen auf emirates.de. Fly Emirates. Fly better.